Hi guys, welcome to the How I Raise It podcast, the show where we get an inside, unfiltered look at how real entrepreneurs and VCs raise capital for their businesses. I'm your host, Nathan Beckard, and today's episode is with Karim Daba of Volo Earth, a venture capital fund that invests in startups doing climate tech, things such as decarbonization, electricity, mobility, and other categories. We talk about how he raised $90 million, which is very large for a first-time fund. And he shares his tips for pitching foundations and fund-to-funds. He also gives advice for climate tech entrepreneurs. If you're tuning into this podcast, learn how to raise capital for your business, I've created a super valuable free welcome package for you. It includes a list of 2,500 investors who don't require a warm intro, plus 200 questions that investors are going to ask you. It's really going to help you get ready to raise money. To get access to this, please leave us a nice review in the Apple iTunes store. Hit all the stars. Leave us a nice comment or two, and then email us at info@foundersuite.com, and we'll send that to you right away. Last but not least, if you enjoy this conversation and think someone else would too, please share it with them. Hit that subscribe button to get all our latest episodes. We really appreciate that. Thank you. Now sit back and enjoy this chat with Karim.
Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. But I have Karim Daba of Volo Earth Ventures coming to us from Revelstoke in the Canadian Rockies. Did I get all that right?
Yeah, Revelstoke is the name.
Revelstoke, cool. Yeah. That's an even cooler name than Revelstoke. Revelstoke.
Yeah. The Stoke is high up here. Yeah.
I like it. And it's a ski town, yes? What's the...
Yeah. It's an outdoors town, skiing, biking, you name it. You know, we have it. And it's in kind of the remote eastern side of British Columbia in the Canadian Rockies.
And I'm in California, and Tahoe's been getting the most epic snowfall in decades. Are you guys getting the same storm patterns coming through? Do you have great snow?
Yeah, we get some of that for sure. We share a lot of the same storm systems with kind of our southern counterparts, and then we get some that come from the north, kind of from the Alaskan and Aleutian Basin as well. So it's kind of a mixed bag. We get a decent amount of snow here. I won't say this has been the biggest year in Revelstoke, but it's been some great skiing.
And are you a skier or snowboarder or both?
I ski. I used to do both, but these days I primarily just ski. But I do, a lot of different types of skiing, backcountry, on resort, what have you.
Very cool. Last question. What's the resort name? Is it Revelstoke Ski Resort or something else?
Revelstoke Mountain Resort, RMR for short, is what people call it. It's on the Icon Pass, I believe.
Okay.
Those people that have it, it's worth a visit.
Awesome. Let's get into what you guys do. Tell us about Volo Earth Ventures.
Yeah, so we're an early stage climate tech venture capital firm. Early stage being kind of seed to Series A. That's our sweet spot, and we really like to build quality relationships and invest in founders and teams that are doing great work in decarbonization, doing that work profitably, and really kind of mission aligned in making a difference. And our typical check size can be from a few hundred K up to a few million. And we like to lead and co-lead rounds, but we don't have to. We take a very kind of hands-on approach with the teams that we work with. And we invest in areas that kind of overlap with our expertise. Those areas are electricity, mobility, buildings, and what we call embodied carbon, which some may call kind of industry or supply chain.
Excellent. How big is the fund?
So fund one, which is what we're currently investing out of, we closed it in spring of last year, just shy of 90 million. I think we were able to kind of build some good momentum, given our backgrounds in the space and our operational kind of history working in climate tech. And we feel like we got to a good number. We were targeting 50 million for the first fund. So we were able to, kind of blow past that and get some good interest in, and we'll be looking to kind of more vehicles in the future.
So we'll come back to that. I did see that you went out to raise 50 and ended up raising 90. That's huge. So I want to get into how, why, what made that happen. But let's get into a little bit of the history first. So what were you doing before this, and where did this idea for this fund come from?
Yeah, my background is heavy in the solar industry. I was kind of based in the Bay Area in SF for a long time and was an early employee at SolarCity and then Sunrun in the solar industry. And then I was part of the founding team with Aurora Solar, which is a software design automation platform. After that, I spent some time in Colorado and worked at the Rocky Mountain Institute and really collaborated closely with Joe Goodman, who's another co-founder and managing partner at the firm. And the two of us worked together at RMI and had known each other for a few years before that in the solar industry. And then I took a few years off and moved up here to Canada. And then we were sort of given the opportunity to put a team together and launch a climate tech VC fund to move the needle a little more with climate investing. Joe had actually left RMI as well and was working with David Vogel, who's our angel and seed investor, who runs a hedge fund firm called Volo Ridge. That has some climate-focused strategies as well. And we were given an opportunity to build a team, and we did. We've got three other founding managing partners that focus on finance, general counsel, and fundraising, as well as on the investment team with Joe and I. And we really kind of have this purpose-built team where, each of us wears some specific hats and then cross-pollinates, with the full team. And we've been able to grow the team now, and we have 10 total folks at the firm. And we really kind of took a thoughtful approach to building out the team for scale, speed, and investment success.
How did it actually come to you though? I'm picturing you guys in a hot tub after a long day on the slopes saying, "Hey, you know what'd be cool if we should start a venture fund." No. I mean, what was the actual like catalyst or genesis, right?
That's funny. Yeah, it really does go back, I feel like, at least to some of Joe and I's work at RMI together.
What is RMI? What is that?
Sorry, yeah, I take it for granted, but that's unfair of me. The Rocky Mountain Institute.
And what does that do, though?
They're an energy sustainability think do tank. They've grown quite a large organization over the last 10 years, but really focused on the energy transition as a nonprofit. And Joe and I's work there, we were on various teams in the kind of electricity practice that did a bunch of kind of market analysis, also, worked with large companies and to help them develop their energy transition strategy. And I think what was interesting, what kept reemerging to Joe and I was, our backgrounds, having worked for over a decade apiece, if not more, in technology and in climate tech and solar and wind. Joe spent time working at GE and has a PhD from Georgia Tech. And we've both kind of committed our lives, our adult lives at least, to working in climate tech and working in technology. And I think we consistently kind of felt this theme reemerging that we're getting really good at helping companies and helping folks kind of assess what an energy transition might look like, whether it's for their company, whether it's for a profitable future, or whether it's for, folks looking to deploy capital into the space, kind of where and how to do it. And I think that was really probably the genesis of, of Joe and I kind of and others in our ecosystem figuring out that we might be able to really direct some meaningful capital into this space and direct it well and understand the right technologies and hopefully produce a good return for our investors.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, great. Well, let's get into the fundraising portion. So you guys say, hey, we've got these great complementary backgrounds, big opportunity in this space as companies are, doing energy transition. Let's raise a fund. So where do you start once you made the decision to raise a fund? What's next?
Yeah, well, we were kind of lucky enough to have some quality anchor and seed investors, like I mentioned, David Vogel and his wife Thais Lopez, as well as some others from Volo Ridge, who really believed in us, from day one. We had some angel investing experience, and I've been an angel investor in my own kind of circles for a little while, but we didn't have official venture capital experience, right? We were sort of, very much like a seed stage fundraise for founders. There's not a lot to hang your hat on, in terms of metrics and success thus far. And we quantified everything that we could, and, kind of, I think, I think really for us, it was people that believed in us, people that really liked our backgrounds and the way we were talking about the energy transition and the way we were sort of modeling and defining how we were going to deploy capital into the space and what was important to us, and you just build on that. We were able to build on that, and we were able to have some really great conversations with other high net worth individuals. And then that grew to some institutions, and Credit Suisse joined our first fund and others. And, we really were able to kind of build the story.
No, that's, you're making it sound way too easy. I mean, maybe it was, but that's good. So you've got this background, you guys work together, you have a thesis, I mean, assuming, and some angel investors. So you're putting this all into a deck. We've made these investments on our own. We've been doing this. And, I guess how much do you go out and raise from angels before you start to go towards institutionals? $90 million for a first-time fund is a big fund for a first-time fund, right? A lot of people are raising much smaller. So I'm trying to unpack those little steps getting to that 90 million.
No, and just to clarify, I would not define it as easy. It was a lot of work. As I said, I mean, we've got this amazing founding kind of purpose built team, which really allowed us, that's a little bit larger probably than most founding venture teams, right? That you see out there. That really allowed us all to focus a lot on kind of what our core abilities and our core needs were for the firm. And so we used the capital that we had started with, which was, sub $20 million. And we started investing immediately. We were like, okay. We just need to go do this, right? We don't know how we're going to get to 50. We don't know how, if we're going to break that or if we're even going to get there. But what we do know is we want to invest capital and accelerate the energy transition. We know that we can, diligence tech and teams. We've been there before. We've built our own companies, and we just need to do it. And so, some of our initial work overlapped with some accelerators that we still work with, like Third Derivative, for example, which is an accelerator that launched out of the Rocky Mountain Institute in late 2020, actually right alongside of sort of our launch. And, we worked closely with that team because we knew them from our work at RMI, and we were able to sort of help them kind of with some initial diligence. We looked at their, application list of 800 applicants and kind of, we worked with them to kind of, through their down selection process to their first cohort of companies. And we actually made a few investments right off the bat from Third Derivative's, first cohort. And really started building our deal flow channels, where and how we like to find companies, universities, accelerators, network, et cetera. And we really started to kind of curate that through that process. But, as we were essentially doing our first close and having some of those early discussions, we were also making small investments, which let us, not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. We were out there. We were doing it. We were taking risks. We were getting our hands dirty. We were learning. We were, we were working hands on with great founders, and we could tell those stories kind of immediately during the fundraise process. So I think what really helped us, especially in the early days, was the fact that we were doing those things in parallel, basically.
Yeah, that's good. What, put it on a timeline if you can, if you don't mind, like from kind of saying we're launching this venture fund to maybe that first close, what, how long does that take?
It's about a year and a half.
And first close like 20 million or somewhere around there?
Yeah,
or?
I mean, kind of less actually. And then fast forward a year and a half later. I mean, we did the first close, I want to say like almost at the turn of the new year in 2021. And then we did our final close in spring of 2022. So yeah, just about a year and a half, and we had, before doing the first close, we had, 6 to 8 months of work leading up to that, just to sort of launch the firm and be in a position to do that. So the whole process took about a year and a half, but we were making investments right alongside of that first close, smaller check sizes to sort of, commensurate with where we were at, but we were there.
So what, between that first close, sub 20 or somewhere around 20, and then that final close of 90, where it, and you were targeting 50. So it got hot, right? I'm reading between the lines here. The deal got hot at some point, but you're making these investments and they haven't exited yet. Maybe some of them are marked up on valuation and stuff like that. Like, what kind of made it get hot, I guess, is really the question I'm trying to get at here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to lie. I think our timing was good, as you and many of your viewers probably know. Like 2021 and early 2022 were good years, especially for climate tech market and the market in general. You know, capital was flowing, people were excited. I would say, you know, climate tech as a vertical has remained sort of in that category of having strong tailwinds and sort of, you know, being a little bit insulated maybe from the rest of the market right now. But our timing was good, so we had a lot of excitement. But you're right, you're spot on. I mean, we didn't have exits. We had very, very few data points. We were essentially going off of kind of, you know, some of those early investments, some throughout the process, some upticks in valuation, as you pointed out, but, you know, no distributions to our LPs, no exits. And actually, we had one small, very early exit, but, you know, no major data points that could say, you know, hey, our fund is going to perform in this way, or we've done this, you know, this before. And I think that's the story for most, you know, VC firms, right? I mean, a fund, an early stage venture fund has a 10 plus year life, and you're really, you know, by the time you're raising fund three, you're still maybe just getting to some returns from fund one. So there's always this lag. I think really what that means is, you know, because we didn't have any real metrics, our metrics were sort of planted in our investment thesis, our backgrounds, and how that resonated with, you know, potential investors.
Interesting. Okay. So sort of summarize, like, strong team, started out with that. Timing was good. Your thesis is kind of trendy or you know, popular, in favor, mm-hmm. right, at the moment, right? And these things come and go. And LPs like the deals you had been doing. Maybe, does that summarize it?
I think that summarizes it. Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of similar to the struggle of, you know, seed stage entrepreneurs trying to raise money as well, right? It's, you don't have the metrics to justify that your business is going to be successful. You're likely pre-revenue. You know, it's all about kind of relationships, thesis alignment. You know, can people get on board with your mission, and things like that. And I think, you know, it just carries up the ladder, right? We're doing that to folks with bigger pots of money, and then we're, you know, trying to pay it forward and transition it down to, you know, to startups.
Very cool. When you started to shift your focus a bit from, you know, angels, high net worth to institutions like Credit Suisse, how does that whole, what are the discussions look like? How does it change? What are the changes between talking to angels and institutions?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a sophistication shift there. I think, you know, you've really got to like pull out the data validation. And as we've just discussed, there isn't a whole lot of data, but whatever you have, you've got to quantify it and validate it and be ready to back that up with, you know, third parties or what have you, to ensure that, because, you know, sophisticated investors will look, right? That's their job. They have to. And so, you know, it transitions from storytelling to storytelling plus, you know, data and validation. And I think, you know, we were able to sort of pull that out with some of the larger investors. Those conversations started later in the cycle, right? So we did have some data, as I pointed to, and some we could point to, you know, some metrics. And, you know, I think we had to put some of our CEOs on the line to, you know, to vouch for us, right? that's the validation part, like some references, and you know, we had to sort of put all hands on deck. But you know, and look, I mean, there are some institutions that won't touch first-time fund managers. Like we learned things the hard way as well, right? Like there, it wasn't all rosy, and not everybody was like, "Oh yeah, what you guys are saying makes total sense. We're in." You know, like it wasn't totally like that. It was, you know, some folks were able to get kind of comfort and really believe and see, you know, our mission, and others were just like, you know, come back to us when you have more data.
And you're kind of feeding my next question, or that's what I was going to ask next, is how did you identify institutional LPs that were willing to gamble or back a first-time fund? Because I think a lot of them do seem to want to say, come back to us when you've, nice to meet you, great to hear about your thesis, come back when you're on fund number three, right? Yeah. So yeah. How did you find ones that back first-time funds?
Yeah, I mean, we weren't necessarily looking for that. And you know, I mean, I think it's possible that, you know, that rules are not always set in stone for everyone, right? I think there's flexibility, I think, on both sides. And I think, you know, if you really meet people that that you resonate with, like, you're going to get something done, you know?
Did you try and find LPs that state that they do first-time funds, or did you just meet with LPs that might have a residence with your thesis and you'd kind of...
Yeah, no, I think it was more of that. Yeah, it was not as rigorous as, like, here's a list that does and doesn't, you know, do first-time funds. We were out there, you know, pounding the pavement with everyone. And Chris Tuller on our side, who's one of the five founding managing partners, he actually heads our fundraising strategy. It was an all-hands-on-deck effort, but he kind of led that effort. We were out there talking to everyone that wanted to listen to our story, right? And I think that's what you got to do, especially in, you know, in the venture fundraising climate, and especially when you don't have, you know, key data points to back it up.
For sure. Yeah. Any sense on how many total investors you talked to? This is one of these questions I always ask, like, top of the funnel and then the bottom of the funnel. How many did you talk to end up with X number of investors?
Any yeah. Sense? We haven't totally solidified, like, exactly what the funnel kind of step-to-step ratios are, but I mean, I'll say it was a lot. Yeah. We definitely, you know, as climate tech is an exciting space, and, you know, we've got, let's just say, kind of aligned backgrounds in this space. We had a lot of conversations, right? But to get to that 90 was, you know, a lot of filtering.
Do you know how many LPs actually are on, like, how many did you end up with? What's the bottom?
Well, the SEC, I think, limits us to 100 or 90.
Oh, okay.
But we're less than that. Significantly less than that. So, you know, it ended up being a mix of high net worth individuals, some institutions, you know, some small checks, some big checks, and, you know, it kind of just gets together.
I read one of the press releases, I think, talking about how, you know, very diverse base of investors, Credit Suisse, and foundations, fund of funds, and private equity. So maybe let's go on each of those. Like, any tips for raising from foundations, for example? What, how do you get in front of them, and what are they looking for? Maybe tell us, you know, foundation raising capital from foundations 101. Give us a little quick primer.
Yeah, it's I think foundations are more concerned about the mission and the vision, right? They want thesis alignment. Really, if you do your homework and you understand what the foundation is about, and you find that really kind of aligns well with your thesis, it should be a good fit to have a strong conversation and get to the finish line, unless there are, you know, very specific hurdles that can't be, you know, that can't be surmounted. So it's really all about kind of how, you know, for us, like, some of the foundations just, you know, they got excited that we generate an impact report, that we require every investment we invest in, every company we invest in, to have quantifiable carbon benefit. And we quantify that on, you know, on the back end and, you know, deliver a report to our LPs that can give them some indication of, you know, tons per dollar, let's say, tons of CO2 equivalent per dollar, kind of offset by their investment in our fund. And so, you know, I think we're not alone as a venture firm in doing that type of reporting, but I think that ours definitely, you know, is pretty grounded in the analysis and the way that it's done. And I think that really resonated pretty well with some of those foundation, you know, check writers.
Yeah. Kind of same question for fund of funds. Like, what really moves the needle for fund of funds? Yeah.
Yeah, fund of funds are going to be more kind of looking for what's your investment sort of time frame, check size, you know, are you early, are you middle, are you late? Because they've got a composition to manage on their end, just like we have a composition of portfolio companies within a fund that we need to manage to the expectation of our sort of LPs and what we've indicated. A fund to fund, manager has a similar composition to manage for their LPs. And so I think that what's important is really working with them on, what is kind of our expected portfolio composition, our expected check size and stage, and, does that fit with sort of their portfolio composition? And then, of course, they're going to do all the normal sort of diligence around, your team, your background, and potentially kind of any data points from early investments that you've already made, right?
Excellent.
And they'll probably want to talk to, a few of our CEOs and things like that, right?
Very cool. Anything else? What other, any anecdotes or, one of the questions I always ask people is like any advice you would give your younger self, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago, on raising a first time fund, if you were doing this all over again?
There's definitely some battle scars. There's definitely, some learning points on, things you should or shouldn't say, I think the advice is probably, especially in today's climate, no pun intended, don't take anything for granted, you might think you have something locked up, or you might think that you're so aligned with somebody, only to find out that it's not a good fit, or, there are other circumstances that kind of preclude the situation that are out of your control. The market could turn as well. I mean, what was interesting was, we were sort of our final close was right when the market started getting pretty jittery. We're talking kind of early last year, right? About a year ago today. And we were sort of gearing up for final close, and we were like, man, like we got, kind of line of sight to maybe a, to this great final close, and it's looking good. And then, markets get jittery and things change. Right. We still ended up with a great result, but it just don't take anything for granted. There are a lot of variables that can change very quickly, that can, make or break a fundraise, whether it's for a company or for a fund, that should not be taken for granted. You need to have backup plans. You need to stick to your guns and know what you're doing. You need to have as much data as possible, and you really need to like keep processes moving.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. I always tell founders, I'd talk to more founders raising from venture funds than I do venture funds raising from LPs, but I always make the bad joke is like, how do you know when an investor says yes when their check actually clears?
That's right.
Bank account, right? Everything else is a maybe.
That's right. And even if people tell you yes, like on the phone, like that's not always, that's not 100%. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's yes, but it's contingent on these things, right? Like, yeah, sometimes there's a little.
Exactly. There's always an asterisk or or some fine print, and market conditions are out of the control of that fine print as well, right? So it's. It's not always, you just can't take it for granted.
Let's shift a little bit here and I'll let you go pretty soon. But what opportunities do you really see in clean tech right now? Like what are some more narrow or niche focuses that you think have a lot of opportunity that you're kind of looking to do deals in? Let's start with that.
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement around climate tech in general, clean tech, climate tech, green tech, whatever people might call it. Sort of I think a lot of people have centered on the nomenclature of climate tech, but there's a tremendous amount of influx of talent into this space, for those people looking to get into climate tech from other industries or other tech layoffs. There's websites out there like Climate Draft and others that can really kind of mobilize talent into the space. And then of course, our own portfolio companies, for example, are all hiring. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of different areas. I think for fund one here, at the beginning parts of this decade, let's say, the most two probably exciting things are, storage and HVAC, probably.
Storage and what was the second one?
HVAC, heating and cooling of building. happens. I think that, you know, there's a lot of other areas of climate tech, including, you know, renewable energy and generation and all kinds of things, grid efficiency. I mean, we take a, you know, and of course, alternative foods and processes, ag tech and circular economy plays. I mean, there's so much. And of course, all the carbon capture, you know, stuff as well. But I think you'll notice, for those who sort of look at our fund, that, you know, we really believe that storage and kind of HVAC technologies, those are big umbrellas, right? There's a lot in those. But those are areas that are hugely needed in this, you know, to be successful in this energy transition. You know, I think there's a lot to gain in solar and wind. There's a lot to gain in grid efficiency and all these other things in industry. But, you know, I think really, you know, the way we heat and cool our buildings kind of needs to become much more efficient, needs to, you know, have more automation, needs to have better technology. And of course, if we're going to transition to a world with solar and wind and everything else, you know, kind of and distributed energy resources at our fingertips, like we need batteries, we need other types of storage, and we need them to be cost efficient and be able to be deployed in a home or on the grid, you know, or in a car, right? Not today, but yesterday, right?
Interesting. Yeah, we had, for anyone really into this space, it's been a couple of years, but we had Block Power, one of your portfolio companies, on here, and they're doing building HVAC.
That's right.
Yeah,
building electrification, let's call it, right? Yeah, that's right.
Let's check that episode out if you want to learn more about them. What's your favorite, or not necessarily favorite, what's the most interesting, creative energy storage system you've run across? And I've seen some crazy things out there. Yeah.
It's hard to pick a favorite, and it's also hard to pick a winner. We've seen, you know, so many different technologies under the energy storage umbrella, long duration, short duration, you know, of course, lithium, non-lithium. I mean, there's so much. There's flow batteries. There's, you know, there's gravity batteries. There's so many different types of storage. And that's what makes the whole field so exciting, is that, you know, not one type of storage is going to be right for another application, for every application, right? So, like, you know, what we need in our cars is not what we need on our grids, and what we need, you know, in our homes may not be suitable for industrial applications, right? So there's just a lot of different types of storage that you can sort of play with to optimize a fully distributed and renewable energy system. And that's something that we've, you know, really looked at closely, including software, including battery management system software. You know, so there's a whole ecosystem there, and it's kind of impossible to sort of, you know, pick one. But there's a lot, and then there's even technology in our portfolio. Let's highlight just, you know, Blue Frontier, which is a hyper efficient liquid desiccant based cooling technology. You know, technically HVAC, and they've actually got, you know, an integrated storage system. And this is a proprietary kind of liquid desiccant regeneration storage tank that allows them to have kind of internal storage capability, but it wouldn't even be a battery standalone in other applications. And so, you know, there's so many facets of storage that just make the whole field so exciting.
Yeah, this is a random question that just popped in my head, but I'll ask it anyway. You know, you're investing things to improve the climate and everything else. Are you sort of by default anti-cryptocurrency, because, you know, you hear about how much energy it takes to generate Bitcoin miners and things like that? Like, is it just immediate, like, clash between
guys? fair points. I mean, I wouldn't say it's immediate clash. You know, I think that I do think that the Bitcoin, at least, let's just pick on them for a second, because there are other cryptocurrencies that are not nearly as energy as energy intensive. But yeah, I mean, Bitcoin's got a problem, you know, and a bit of a black eye from the energy intensity, that's for sure. They're going to need to solve that. Not that it can't be, though. I mean, you know, if Iceland wants to co-locate, you know, all the Bitcoin mines right next to their, you know, enormous geothermal energy potential and have it all be renewable, like, fine, great, you know. But there's also a lot of real kind of need for that clean energy to be flowing elsewhere into our grids and our homes and businesses for us to really decarbonize the future. So there's certainly a bit of a push and a pull there.
Yeah, interesting. Great. All right. Well, any advice or tips for founders in clean tech, maybe, you know, that are getting out there to raise capital? It's a tough market right now, but what advice do you kind of find yourself giving clean tech founders?
Yeah, I think, I think we kind of highlighted this a little bit before. It's, you know, validated data points. I mean, you've got, you know, many founders are great at storytelling, not all. So some may not be, but, you know, I think, you know, talking about and getting excited about your mission and your vision and what your tech can do, and what the roadmap looks like, you know, those are super important, right? You've got to do that, and you've got to do it well. You've got to resonate with the folks around the table that you're trying to raise money from, and you've got to, you know, kind of create that alignment. But on the flip side, you know, the more that you can validate, the more you can validate on your revenue, third party validate on your tech, have strong advisors at the table that can vouch for you as individuals and your backstory, have strong kind of early customers committed to buying your tech. All those pieces kind of serve as validation, right? That the market is ready to adopt this kind of tech, and that, you know, you and your team at least will have a shot at doing what you say you're going to do, right? Which is grow a $1 billion company or whatever it is, right? Which is what most companies say they're going to do, and 90%+ of them fail, right? So it's really about, you know, the storytelling and the vision coupled with the validation.
Yep,
as much as possible. And that's hard as a seed stage company, but the you know, as much as you can do goes a long way.
Cool. Anything you want to, any shout outs or cast outs you want to do? Hey, if you're a certain type of HVAC startup, give us a shout, or, you know.
I think the biggest shout out is, you know, if you're interested in climate tech and, or, you know, you're looking for a career in climate tech and, or you're looking to change careers into climate tech, you know, get on board. We're doing something super meaningful. We're building technologies that win on economics, that create profitable companies, and that decarbonize, you know, our systems. And I think that's something that, you know, speaking of storytelling, that people can tell future generations to and point to, you know, this time on planet Earth as a transition, when we transition to a sustainable future for, you know, for humanity and for all species on the planet.
God, I hope so. It's sometimes easy to just get depressed about it all, because, you know, like even something as simple as recycling, I feel like pandemic pushed us a few steps back, you know, in terms of how people are recycling or using more plastic. I don't know. I won't get into my soapbox here, but you feel like we're on the right track overall. Is it, you know, taken from the 50,000 foot view, are we moving in the right direction on most of these fronts or what?
I hope so. I don't have anything better to do with my life and my time, so I'm going to keep putting, you know, as much of my effort into decarbonization and the energy transition as much as possible. And I hope so. But the forces that are at work here are massive. And so it's a little bit, you know, it's not easy to answer that question. We're going to throw everything we can at it and, you know, hope that we can kind of make this transition happen and be successful.
Have you guys, I'll let you go in 30 seconds, I promise, but have you guys done a circular economy startup? I think some of those are really kind of interesting.
We have, yeah, we've looked at a few, and there are definitely some exciting ones. You know, Ncycle in our portfolio is a battery recycling company. Polycarbon in our portfolio does single use medical plastics. You know, so there are, and I mean, you know, anywhere you look, you're starting to see circular economy plays, you know, kind of emerging, and that's super exciting, because, you know, anyone who rightly calls out that, you know, this energy transition is going to take a lot of minerals and a lot of materials that our supply chains aren't totally used to and, you know, are different from kind of historical supply chains. And that is, you know, that's something that we need to be very cognizant of and decarbonize and, you know, make sustainable as well. So yeah, it's a crucial piece.
Excellent. If people want to learn more, what's the best way to either find out about your fund or connect with you or whatever you want to put out here. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, you know, our website has at least some kind of base information, and then you can check us out on LinkedIn. We've got a company page and we're all active there as well. And, you know, really, I think you can hear the most about us from our amazing portfolio companies. So that's also a great place to look.
VoloEarth.com. What does Volo mean?
That's a portmanteau of David Vogel and Thais Lopez, who are our angel investors. And that's where the Volo comes from.
VoloEarth.com. Excellent. Well, thanks much. And very good. We'll keep doing what you're doing, saving us from ourselves, hopefully. And we'll catch you after your next big raise.
Thanks, Nathan. Appreciate that. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Over and out. Bye.